and welcome to the Belt and Road podcast. We cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I am your host, Eric Mike Storino, coming to you today from a very pleasant Durham, North Carolina. And today I'm so happy to have back Juliet. Juliet, how's it going in, well, your new place?
Yeah, so I moved to Ithaca, New York State, and it's really nice here. It's actually way warmer than California in the summer. So happy to be here. Happy to be back on the podcast.
And congratulations. What will you be doing there?
Sustainability postdoc. So studying more Chinese rubber.
Beautiful. So congratulations on filling in your dissertation or handing it in and on a new position. Thanks. And for the cross-country move. Before we start, I'd just like to remind everyone, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis and discussions on the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod.
Today, we're really excited to be talking about the Green Belt and Road. In general, I think we hear really conflicting things about China's role in shaping sustainable global development. You know, one day I'll see a video praising China's massive tree planting schemes. The next day I'll see kind of an expose on industrial pollution in China. And research on the environmental implications of the Belt and Road is also really mixed. So we see some people will highlight China's investments in renewables, sometimes glossing over environmental impacts as, you know, inevitabilities of development. Others will tally up, you know, every environmental cost of BRI projects. And these usually come to terrifying totals. So there's a really a mixed bag in terms of how China's Belt and Road is covered from an environmental angle. Regardless, it's very clear that Chinese political leaders have been prioritizing promoting ideals of what they call eco-civilization, that's primarily domestically, and green development through the Belt and Road Initiative. Green development has become a major part of the Belt and Road conversation, and a number of high-profile Belt and Road events and organizations and institutions have centered conversations around the issue of environment and the sustainable development that Belt and Road can promote. Still, this kind of turn towards greening the Belt and Road is very recent. It was only launched in 2017. And as such, there's not been a lot of extensive, comprehensive analysis of its implications to date, in part because I think those are still unfolding. So due to how new all this is, I think today's featured article by Tyler Harlan is one of the first very thorough analyses of China's Green Belt and Road. The article is entitled Green Development or Greenwashing, and Tyler Harlan is an assistant professor in urban and environmental studies at Loyola Marymount University. He works on issues of political economy and uneven socio-environmental impacts of China's green development transformation and the implications of this transformation for other industrializing countries. Tyler, welcome to the Belt and Road podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks, Julia. Thanks, yeah. Eric. Really nice to be with you.
So Tyler, first, tell us a bit about yourself. I know you've studied small hydropower within and beyond China. Walk us through a bit of your background on things like green infrastructure and low carbon investments.
Sure. First of all, I'm at Loyola Marymount University. It's in LA, so I've been at LMU for about a year now. I often tell people I study renewable energy and its relationship to regional and rural development in China, but also in places where Chinese firms are conducting kind of overseas activities, basically Belt and Road country. And so, Eric, you mentioned small hydro. I did focus on small hydropower for my PhD, which seems like a bit of an odd choice, but small hydro is considered to be China's kind of first renewable energy. And it, considering my interest in regional and rural development, it played a huge role in China's rural electrification. And basically 99.9% of Chinese households have electricity access now. So it's been pretty successful. So rural electrification, so mainly in rural China, but also more recently in Western China are considered to be a little bit poorer than those in the East. And so what I found is, you know, briefly is that small hydro kind of had a big boom in the 2000s and early 2010s. Partly due to it kind of being reframed as a renewable energy when the Chinese government started caring about having renewable energy. But more recently, in the last 5 years, it's gone through kind of a complete reversal of government support. The government was super supportive, and now they've basically pulled that entirely. This has had really big consequences for a lot of rural areas in Western China that kind of depend on small hydro. So what has happened then is not only are there those negative consequences domestically, but small hydropower investors are pushed to look for opportunities in other countries. So all that to say is I think First of all, in my PhD, I was curious as to why that support got pulled and why all this happened. But I was also looking for parallels with and lessons for other renewable energies, particularly solar and wind, which are still booming in China. You know, a lot of wind and solar in China has been built in Western China in places that are similar to where hydropower, both large and small, is constructed. And it's also gone through some restrictions recently. And both of those industries have a lot of players, and they're being squeezed to go overseas too. So I do think there are some interesting parallels there. So I have a project, a couple projects going at the moment. One is investigating that boom in solar and wind in Western China and kind of how that happened and why restrictions are in place and what that looks like for regional and rural development. And then another project, which I focused on a bit more in my postdoc, is on Chinese renewable energy investments, mainly in Southeast Asia. And I was doing some field work in Laos and Myanmar.
Tell us first a little bit about, so the Green Belt and Road was kind of announced in 2017. And you make a distinction between, you know, the discourses and debates around it, the way that the Chinese government frames the Green BRI versus mm-hmm. kind of what the record is in terms of actual projects, which are overwhelmingly not green. A lot of them are very brown, as you say, or in high carbon activities. But how did this come about in 2017? And what are the reasons that you kind of trace for this discursive shift towards greening?
I kind of highlight 2017 as a year where maybe we can call it a discursive shift. Maybe just kind of this green BRI discourse came to the forefront a little bit. There was a couple of publications that came out that year. One of these two documents that was published in 2017 is called The Guidance on Promoting the Green Belt and Road. And that was released by the China State Council, but in cooperation with some other ministries. And then there was also the Belt and Road Ecological and Environmental Cooperation Plan. So both of those were released in 2017, which kind of highlights that year as a year when that discourse from the Chinese government, at least, became more prominent. But there's also been a lot of discussion from that point onwards, really, within Chinese scholarship about the Green Belt and Road. And so that's kind of why I think that date, 2017, is a little bit important here. But why this shift or why this focus on the Green Belt and Road in China, the Chinese government and Chinese scholarship? Well, I think one reason is kind of reputational. So it's a response to negative media coverage, mainly in the West, on the environmental impacts of China's overseas investments, which is a discourse, media coverage that's been going on since before the BRI was announced. And I think another is that there's a recognition, and first of all, these aren't just sort of what I've thought about in terms of why this might be the case that we see green BRI discourse, but also what Chinese scholars are saying. I think another is that there's a recognition that there are environmental risks on the Belt and Road of these types of projects, particularly sort of high carbon brown projects. And these might be, say, social unrest due to pollution or social unrest due to a hydropower project that sees protests against it, as we've seen in places like Myanmar. And so if this continues to occur and these risks aren't mitigated, this might impede further investment and political cooperation. So there's a reputational reason. I think there's a risk management reason. And then I think there's also an opportunity reason, which is that Chinese commentators see kind of a huge potential for firms in low carbon industries in China to grow rapidly, expand their market share overseas, particularly in BRI countries. So there's risk, but there's also opportunity.
Right. The idea being that China has a comparative advantage because they've developed some of these technologies so well, right?
Right, right. And China really is a world leader in renewable energy and alternative energy like solar and wind. And so it certainly has the potential. It's well-placed, one would think, to invest in these technologies overseas.
Yeah, and one thing I really loved about your article is it delves into, you know, the politics of how green development is conceptualized and implemented and who benefits. I've seen so many articles that are like, Belt and Road, is it green? You know, it's been around since, you know, the Belt and Road existed as a concept. Mm-hmm. And even before that, when it was China-Africa, where you take these dialogues and it would always cite, well, Xi Jinping talks about ecological civilization and in the Belt and Road without ever explaining or thinking about, you know, what is green development within a China context and what is it in maybe if you want to go broader Western context. Mm-hmm. And so two things that are central in political ecology, the unequal power relations that matter and should be looked at, and that win-win solutions are never really win-win. So can you discuss these two threads and what we might be missing or if not when we're talking about win-win discourses?
Sure. Yeah. And so thanks, Eric. Yeah, I agree that a lot of the let's say, discourse or discussion about the environmental aspects of the Belt and Road, let's say, have been about whether or not it's green. And so there has been a lot of scholarship, if we're talking about scholars, since before the BRI was announced, about environmental impacts of China's overseas investments, basically pointing out what those impacts are and how we might mitigate them. But then arguably since 2017, but maybe earlier, there's been another discussion, a related discussion about how the BRI can be greened. And so there's potential, based on what we were just discussing, for example, China's leadership in renewable energy, for the BRI to be green. So how does one do that? And I think we see a lot of NGOs and sort of policy institutes working in this space, which of course is really important. What I wanted to do with this paper, and thanks for your question leading me into this, is to say that we also need to understand how a green is defined, right? And so I think what I want to do in this paper is say who on the BRI gets to be green and on whose terms. So not just to say is the BRI green or not, but to interrogate a little bit what green means and where green means, if you like. And so what I found, I guess, now this is a review paper, and so there's I don't know if I would describe it as findings, but in reviewing all this, frankly, a lot of excellent literature written on this in the last few years, I found that green is defined and implemented differently across the Belt and Road. So to be a little bit crude here, on the one hand, green commonly refers to investing in what we might call green or low carbon infrastructure. For example, alternative energy generation like solar and wind. These types of projects are still fairly limited on the BRI, and they tend to target higher income countries and regions, with a few exceptions. Again, kind of a crude distinction here, but just for purposes of analysis. And then on the other hand, I argue in the paper, green refers to mitigating environmental risks. Risks associated both with traditional infrastructure, like we might even say brown infrastructure, and ecological degradation in Belt and Road countries that is caused by poverty, which is something related but a little bit different than I'm happy to talk about. And so these types of risk mitigation activities are much more common on the BRI, I argue, and they tend to target lower income countries and regions. And because the policies and regulations around risk mitigation are not really adequately enforced, it can lead to greenwashing. So that's where that green development or greenwashing comes into play, is that, again, if we sort of crudely divide countries into, say, in higher income countries, investment is still kind of limited, but it's we see green investments in low carbon infrastructure, but in lower income countries, despite some exceptions, it is mainly about risk mitigation, which can lead to greenwashing.
I had also a follow-up question to that, because I'm always interested when we hear the word that Chinese investment targets something, a certain type of country. And to what degree do you see them as targeting that, or is that just a word that you're using to kind of explain a correlation between the low carbon infrastructure going to richer countries and mitigation projects going to lowering? Do you think it's just, is it a coincidence that they correlate? Do they line up for other reasons? It's not actually active targeting, or do you see that as strategically targeting?
Yeah, I think that's a good point that you make, that maybe target isn't the right word here. I don't think that they're, as you've argued too, Juliet, that the Chinese government is pulling strings here, and that firms are just responding to official policy, and that official policy is something like don't invest in solar and wind in lower income countries. That's clearly not the case here. And there are, in fact, a lot of solar and wind firms that would love to invest in lower income countries if they didn't face the barriers that they do, and if the context in the host country were such where they can make money on that project. I think that there are barriers in place that have prevented firms from doing that to the extent that they would like. And even though there are a few exceptions, particularly in Vietnam, which has released a framework for renewable energy and requires a lot of energy in the future that's making it a good spot for investment, I think that there are, I would say, sort of a myriad of reasons that these types of low carbon infrastructure investments aren't happening in lower income countries, but it's not a directive from the Chinese government.
So you break down the way you review different discussions of greening, right? So you kind of say that there's green finance, green energy, and green cooperation. Yeah, can you just kind of quickly jump around and give us a few examples of each of those? What does green finance actually look like in terms of how China is driving it, and how does China go about doing this, and how do they compare to other investors?
Sure. Yeah, let me give some quick examples here. So I wanted to organize the paper, organize the argument across those three domains, finance, energy, and cooperation, mainly because those are domains that were highlighted by China's Ministry of Ecology and Environment. And so these are clearly areas that the government is sort of considering when it's thinking about the Green BRI. As are Chinese scholars, I don't want to say the state or the government is all one person. But in general, I think they're a helpful way to organize a green BRI and what we're talking about here. So to quickly give some examples, so green finance, one of the things I do in the paper too is I try to, again, break these domains down and say, well, what are we actually talking about when we're talking about green finance? And on the one hand, a lot of studies, a lot of analysis of green finance in China, which is frankly fairly progressive, has been around green bonds. And so these are ways to raise finance for projects that are considered to be green in some way. So generally green infrastructure projects. And so China has one of the world's largest green finance sectors. And there's green finance, or there's green bonds, both these are issued both domestically, and there are green bonds that are issued for overseas projects, which can also be issued along with other lending institutions, not just Chinese ones. And so when we're looking at a green BRI, then we're looking at overseas projects, and these abide by international green standards. These, again, just looking at the data as a whole across the world at the national scale, most of these green bond finance projects have resulted in investments in higher income countries. So they're effectively, besides one project in Pakistan, that's the only project that's been financed from a green Chinese green bond so far on the BRI. And the Pakistan is part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. So right. It's kind of a very high profile initiative. And so there's also a really big solar project there too. But on the other hand, with green finance, you have green credit guidelines. So green credit guidelines can be for traditional infrastructure projects too. And this is China's banking regulator telling Chinese lenders, Chinese banks. So these were first issued in 2007, I think, and they were updated in 2012 and 13. Basically a regulation that these banks must have particular sort of environmental and social guidelines around projects that they lend to. And there are even key performance indicators for overseas projects. And some of these indicators are that the lenders will hire a third party to conduct environmental and social impact assessments, that they will abide by international standards, not just host country standards around environmental impacts. Problem with these green credit guidelines overseas, as a lot of recent analyses have stated, one I'm thinking of is by Friends of the Earth, is that these green credit guidelines in practice are simply just not enforced and implemented very well. Right. So that is indeed often a case of greenwashing. To move a little bit quicker, that was green finance. So green energy, and another part of the paper. Green energy, again, can be a contested concept. Alternative energy, which is another term that I've been using in the podcast, considered to be things like solar and wind, which I mentioned several times. But green energy might also include hydropower, right? Not just small hydropower, but large hydropower too, of which China has some of the world's largest hydropower construction corporations, like China's Three Gorges Dam Corporation and Sinohydro. And so when we're looking at green energy investments, again, solar and wind, alternative energy investments tend to be targeted to end up in higher income countries, and hydropower investments and EPC contracts tend to be in lower income countries. Mm-hmm. Even though there has been some pushback, particularly in Myanmar, against hydropower projects, we do see this distinction. I'm heartened by some recent announcements of Chinese investment in solar and wind in other lower income countries. So I'm hoping this will continue in the future. But as I mentioned a moment ago, there are some barriers to that happening. And so again, that distinction between higher and lower income countries. And then green cooperation, these are projects that are a bit smaller in scale, even though the documents released by the Ministry of Ecology and Environment and the State Council about the Green Belt and Road tend to spend a lot of time on them. They're kind of like partnerships, often with international institutions, to do things like develop sort of ecological monitoring or around training for forest management or wildlife management in other countries. And these are basically all in lower income countries. A lot of them are in Africa and Southeast Asia, and some in Central Asia too. And so there are these different institutes that are situated within Chinese ministries that manage these projects. One that I'm a little bit familiar with is actually about small hydropower, which is, again, framed as renewable energy, framed as green. And this sits within the a Chinese ministry and is also jointly managed by an institute. So again, that kind of tells you about how these projects work. And there have for many years been training programs that invite overseas NGOs, engineers, officials to come to China to learn about small hydro, about green small hydropower, and then implement that back in their host country. So this would be an example of green cooperation. Right. It turns out that what this facilitates is often larger hydropower investments. And I don't necessarily wanted to say that small hydropower is good and large hydropower is bad. It's not that simple. But just to say that there are, just like with any aid and development program by any country, there are some other motivations for these cooperation programs as well.
Right. And as a little aside, just about, yeah, because you put green in quotes when you refer to hydro as a green energy investment. And but it's not just China, right, that considers hydro a green investment. It's widely considered, despite extreme debate, it's widely considered low carbon and therefore green. Is that right? Even though it has huge environmental impacts sometimes?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it was hydropower was included in the Clean Development Mechanism.
Okay, yeah.
As part of the Kyoto Protocol. And yeah, it really, it's this thing about discourses again. And it kind of depends on what discourse or what conversation one is a part of. If you're talking about like low carbon versus high carbon infrastructure, well, clearly hydropower produces less carbon emissions than a coal-fired power plant. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about, say, in a discourse about conservation or talking about environmental impacts on the ground of projects, well, hydropower projects that impound a lot of water, that have large dams, even those that don't, can have severe environmental impacts.
Right.
And so one can on the one hand say, yes, it is low carbon, but nonetheless, not the type of low carbon investment we want to see in the future, especially in these lot of in ecologically fragile areas,
right,
which in areas where people depend on water resources.
Right, which is again why the fact that it's happening much more commonly in lower income countries is so important to distinguish. It's fascinating. Right. Yeah, great.
I think this last question, talking about these three areas, green finance, green energy, green cooperation, particularly green energy and green cooperation, and going back to how green is conceptualized and implemented, you know, it seems like with the amount of money and just the action of creating infrastructure projects throughout the Belt and Road that maybe are conceptualized as green, and the politics of how green is conceptualized and implemented. Within this review, were you able to find a particular Chinese way of conceptualizing and implementing green within the Belt and Road?
Yeah, so the short answer there is I don't think that there is a Chinese specific way of defining and implementing green. You mentioned, or Juliet mentioned, ecological civilization when you were introducing the podcast. And that is the closest we might come to maybe a Chinese conceptualization of green development. It's been part of Chinese government discourse since the early 2010s in the Hu Jintao era. And it's sort of an important pillar of the Chinese Communist Party's vision for the future. And so it's certainly worth engaging with. It is difficult, however, to ascertain what ecological civilization necessarily means. And I think it's like, in a way, and some others might argue with me here, but in a way, kind of like green, kind of like sustainable, you know, these words that are kind of open to interpretation a little bit. And so I would think that the Chinese government in promoting a green BRI knows that that's not something that has clear, concrete steps to take or key performance indicators or whatever that we can measure up and say this is green or not. And so that can kind of remain as a overarching principle, but it's, I think, up to observers and scholars to see what that means in practice. Maybe that was going off on a little bit of a tangent a little bit, but I think that, again, I don't think that there's a narrative or a discourse about green development or green BRI that's being pushed by the Chinese government. Or Chinese firms. There are many different actors here. And I think it is open to interpretation. And that's part of the benefit of a green BRI, is that it is open to interpretation by these different actors.
Yeah. And I like how at the beginning of your article, you start out by saying, like, we already know that the idea of a win-win solution is a myth, right? It's already a myth in many other ecological discourses. It's not like China was the first to stumble upon, you know, greening and sustainability as words that kind of gloss everything in a positive light. But it's right. Very strategic for the government.
Right.
Yeah. So not only does it seem like maybe there's not a Chinese specific idea of green, but on the other hand, China's not the first to use green vaguely strategically. Right.
Right. And I think it's worth pointing out too that folks like us are concerned, of course, about the BRI being green. We want to see more low carbon investments. We don't want to see a high carbon footprint of a BRI, as do a lot of others and a lot of country leaders, you could say. Then there are other country leaders, other governments in host countries that host BRI investments that are not particularly concerned about the greenness of those investments, are not necessarily thinking about lowering their carbon emissions as their key goal while in office, particularly with everything happening with COVID, right? And economies just being destroyed across the planet, and then thinking about how to recover from that, building green infrastructure will likely not be first in their mind. And so I just say that to point out that there is this Chinese government-led discourse about a green BRI, but it doesn't, that Chinese actors, when they're investing in projects, don't necessarily need to frame everything as green. Because there are times and places where that just doesn't matter all that much.
And I wanted to go into a few things that I think our listeners would be interested in that are related, but I know that you haven't published on yet. Mm. But so you've done a lot of research on the Chinese renewable energy industry, both domestically within China, and then you've looked at how Chinese investors are or are not going out in the renewable energy sector. So what are some of the incentives for going out for those investors, and what are some of the barriers to their investment overseas?
Yeah, so thinking about, let's say, I'm going to include small hydro here. I know kind of a strange inclusion into renewable energy, but small hydro, solar, and wind. And so there are not actually very many what I might call incentives for these firms to invest, for Chinese firms to invest overseas right now. And I don't mean they're not interested in it. They are certainly interested in it, but it's mostly all push factors. So increased competition within China due to there just being a glut of firms across all these different industries, a reduction in the amount of projects that are up for grabs in China, especially for smaller firms. Consolidation happening in all three of those industries, and so that the bigger firms get a larger slice of the pie, and just a series of domestic changes in China that make it so that in order to survive, these firms, particularly smaller ones, are interested in overseas markets. Big firms are interested in overseas markets too, and a lot of the investments, those exception investments that I mentioned in solar and wind in lower income countries, have mainly been completed by larger firms. And so that they're certainly interested in investing overseas is my point there. But there are a lot of barriers in place. And these are both domestic and host country. And so on the domestic, I guess the Chinese domestic policy side, renewable energy firms, a lot of them tend to be private firms. And so they don't have the kind of government connections that state-owned enterprises do. And this includes connections and the ability to get finance for projects, particularly in lower income countries that are considered to be risky, because risk is by lenders is considered on a countrywide scale. And it's also difficult for these firms who want to invest in other countries to get insurance, basically, from Sinosure. Towards the end of the podcast, I might point you or point the listeners to an excellent blog post that just came up 3 or 4 days ago on Pawpaw Dragonclaw that goes into some of these in a really detailed way, some of these financial domestic barriers for solar and wind investments. One of the things I've focused on maybe a little bit more in my recent research is on host country barriers, and focusing specifically in Southeast Asia and Laos and Myanmar, and recently a little bit in Vietnam, because these are areas that appear to be ripe for investment. There's a lot of solar and wind resources, and there's a need for electricity and also the potential to export that electricity from those countries to China or to Thailand or even to Singapore. Laos already exports a lot of hydropower to Singapore. But there are barriers in those host countries too. A lot of Chinese investors complain of a lack of a policy framework for renewable energy. And so that means like there's no feed-in tariff or there's no auctions that make it possible for these firms to bid for products and receive the kind of return that they would expect. There's a risk that the grid utility would maybe go bankrupt, but also wouldn't abide by the terms of an agreement, by a power purchasing agreement. I think there's also some technical barriers, particularly with the grid in Laos and Myanmar. Again, in Laos and Myanmar in particular. In Myanmar, the centralized grid does not extend very far into the country. It does not extend at all into areas that are controlled by ethnic militias, and it doesn't even extend very far past Upper Myanmar. In Laos, the grid is considerably more developed, but not as integrated as is necessary for large-scale solar and wind investments. And so there are just some technical infrastructural grid investments that need to be made in order for those countries to be ready for the degree of solar and wind investments that Chinese firms might be interested in. There's one other thing that I wanted to mention, which is that in a lot of what I read and hear, particularly from the Chinese government side, I guess, about the benefits of green Belt and Road and Belt and Road energy investments is that the Belt and Road can increase energy or electricity access. And I could certainly see that being the case for even for things like coal-fired power plants for, say, urban consumers that, in countries that experience blackouts, you know, where that would increase the stability of the energy supply. But often this discourse of energy access is framed in terms of rural electrification, given China's success mainly using small hydro in rural electrification. But the fact of the matter is these investments in small hydro, solar, and wind that are small enough and appropriate for rural electrification just don't really make money. They're not really good investments. And so even though there are a lot of firms that are certainly capable of those types of investments, given the barriers I just described, right. Yeah. They're not able to do so. And so the types that I would like to see, which are smaller scale solar and wind, we might say even distributed solar, wind, and small hydro, tend to be more like grants, like projects that are just given to communities or locally developed, especially in Myanmar and ethnic minority areas. But they're not necessarily considered to be good investments for Chinese firms, even though they're the types of projects that are needed and that we would really like to see.
So would those be like semi-subsidized by the Chinese government, or would they just be like good PR stunts for that firm, or what would even get them to do that in the first
place? So I might have misspoke there. I don't know of any evidence of a Chinese firm doing this type of development work in Myanmar or Laos like that. Mm-hmm. But there are development projects like this from international agencies that gift, say, small hydro or small-scale solar or even just household solar to communities. One could imagine maybe a Chinese firm doing that for PR purposes. But again, this is more... Let me also say that like in places like along the border in Myanmar and Laos, you actually do see a whole lot of Chinese manufactured solar panels and small hydro turbines. But these are just purchased from China or local traders are selling them. That's not like an investment that's being developed by a Chinese small hydro or solar developer.
Got it.
Even though I do think there are opportunities in those areas for Chinese firms. And to stress as well that, again, there are issues with any type of energy technology, right? Solar, wind, and small hydro too. In fact, I just published a paper about the social impacts of small hydro and saying that they can be actually quite severe. And so not to say that small hydro is somehow always good. In particular cases, it can be a useful technology for rural electrification, but it has to be managed and built and managed for local community needs. And if it's built for like distant urban consumers, or if they're approved without a lot of oversight, as is what happened in Laos over the last few years, then you got a lot of small plants that have outsized impacts. And so just to throw that in there as well, that it depends on how the energy is being built, constructed, used, managed, all of the above. Mm-hmm.
Well, kind of wrapping up, I mean, there's a million different ways to define the Belt and Road. And I thought some of the ways that you defined it in the article were really useful. You step away from this idea that it's a geopolitical grand strategy. You're drawing from a couple other people. If listeners are interested in who you're citing, they can go to the article text. You refer to it as a relational contested process, something in which you're looking at in terms of the not just the policies on paper, but also the discourses and how kind of those discourses line up or don't line up with projects on the ground. You say that they sometimes align and sometimes they're contradictory. And then I really like this point you draw from, you're citing two other articles as well, this idea that there are pronouncements made by China's leaders, and then those are negotiated and kind of reinterpreted by lower level governments, business groups, a range of actors, really. Yeah. You say that your aim is to highlight that there are common elements to the green BRI rhetoric, but BRI is not a coherent top-down program. Any other comments on why it's important to see the green BRI that way? I think you make a cohesive case as to it that we miss out on important aspects of analysis when we reify the BRI as coherent top-down mandated from Beijing.
Yeah, thanks. And that that framing comes from an intro article to a new special issue, which I was lucky enough to be involved in as an editor, that looks at Belt and Road projects, what we say, from the ground. And so I'd actually recommend this to listeners, not because of my involvement, but because there's just a whole bunch of fantastic articles in that special issue in Political Geography. So, but yes, I do think that, and I think many scholars would agree that it's best to view the BRI not, again, as a top-down program, not as something that's coherent, even from on high, even from pronouncements in Beijing, but something that is constantly shifting and from policies down to implementation gets, as you say, kind of renegotiated and reinterpreted by different actors who have different aims. And in the case of the Green BRI, this means that, again, maybe to Eric's question from earlier about, is there a Chinese, like a Chinese way of interpreting the Green BRI? And I answered no. And I think that bears in this response here too, which is that green can be interpreted in many different ways, depending on context. And Chinese actors in host countries have taken that on board and interpreted it in different ways. What I wanted to do in this article is not just say, oh, the Green BRI can be anything and everything, but to say that there are some common elements here, you know, low carbon infrastructure, mitigating environmental risk. Nevertheless, these aren't the only two elements. And it's worthwhile to try to organize our thinking and sort of try our best to sort of figure out what's going on with the Green BRI without saying that this is a top-down program or that actors act in this way or they act in this way. You know, they either mitigate risk or they're investing in low carbon infrastructure. It can be a combination of both. It can be something else.
Yeah, I think that follows a lot of the views that we try to highlight on this podcast.
Go ahead, Eric. Yeah, it's kind of all of the podcast. It's turned out best.
That's right. I was just going to mention, you know, Juliet's work on this topic too. And Juliet, you don't have to include this in the podcast, but I remember when you posted a photo and a presentation that showed in Laos, like a local hardware store or something. And it was like Belt and Road Hardware or something like that. I can't remember what it was, like agricultural goods. And I was like, exactly.
It's just the new hot thing to name yourself after.
So that's right. I think there's certainly a group of, many scholars would agree that it's a kind of this, again, relational contested process rather than a top-down policy.
Great. Probably very off topic. I don't know if I'll include that in the recording, but it was interesting. For the first time ever, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, I saw a Chinese company publicly declare an apology about putting the phrase Belt and Road as a part of their investment. It was one of these special economic zones that are really fronts for online casinos and hotels in northern Myanmar. And there was a private investor, Chinese national, who got a second citizenship in Cambodia, and he has a large spa in the Philippines, and he brought about the special economic zone and called it part of the Belt and Road Initiative. And it got called out in a few different publications. And I don't know who felt the heat, but they did an interview with, I think it was Frontier in Myanmar, and said, "We are not the Belt and Road. We apologize."
Wow. Yeah,
so that was really interesting.
Man, thanks for sharing. That's very interesting. And to follow up on that, you know, and again, to point listeners to this new special issue, it can also, this can also be done by host country governments and host country actors to sort of frame particular infrastructure needs or particular projects that they desire as suitable for Belt and Road investments, so as to obtain that type of investment from Chinese firm.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating.
Tyler, this has been a really enlightening conversation. Thank you so much for your writing and for coming on the show today. Will you stick around for recommendations?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Remember, again, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis on the Belt and Road Initiative, follow us at Belt and Road Pod. Tyler, what would you recommend our listeners to be watching or reading or whatever these days?
Yeah, so there's so much good stuff out there. You know, it's hard to choose. I did mention earlier in the podcast, beyond the special issue, which I'll, as I mentioned, share with you later, there's a great blog called Panda Paw Dragon Claw. It's at pandapawdragonclaw.blog. And I point to this, it's about Chinese environmental footprint beyond its border. But there was a great post by Ma Tianjie just a few days, actually it's been about a month ago, about some of the barriers that solar and wind firms face in investing in Belt and Road countries, focusing mainly on the domestic side, so domestic financial barriers. So I recommend the listeners give that a read. That's a really excellent analysis of those financial barriers.
I don't know how he does it. He's all over the place, Ma Tianjie, and he writes so well.
Yeah. And he's also, of course, featured in China Dialogue quite a good bit. On a slightly different note, there has been a lot of good analysis and I would say reports of late about how hydropower could be replaced by solar and wind or have its role reduced and changed with an increase in solar and wind investments, both in, I guess, Belt and Road countries and also just more generally. And so in January in China Dialogue, Brian Eiler, who's with the Stimson Center, I know both of you know him, wrote about solar diplomacy, Chinese solar diplomacy in the Belt and Road, and particularly in Mekong countries, and how solar might, again, replace particular hydropower projects and reduce their role as an energy source in those countries. And then WWF and I think NDRC recently came out with a report called Connected and Flowing, A Renewable Future for Rivers, Climate, and People. And Jeff Opperman, who's with WWF, is one of the leading authors of that. And that's, again, more generally about how solar and wind can be ramped up in particularly in areas that would experience increased hydropower investment and replace or reduce hydropower's role in meeting climate commitments, carbon commitments. And so I think both of those would be of interest to listeners who are wondering about the future role of our alternative energy in countries' energy portfolios.
Wonderful. Nice. And we'll put all those in the show notes. Juliet, do you have any recommendations?
I have picked up a book that I started a very long time ago when I was living in Yunnan, The Forgotten Kingdom, 9 years in Yunnan from 1939 to 1948. What makes this book so amazing is that it's written by this author, Peter Guyar. He's Russian-born, grew up in Paris and Moscow, but he spends a lot of time living in, he moves with his mother after the Bolshevik Revolution to Shanghai, and then he gets a job with the Kuomintang in Lijiang. At first he's in Sichuan, and then he moves to Lijiang. And the story is incredible. And his writing is so good because he's like one of those people who are just a natural observer, like natural born anthropologist of some sort. And he runs a clinic, but also runs a program where he promotes local crafts and local cooperatives. And so he lives in Yunnan for 9 years, specifically in Lijiang, at this place where, you know, it's the crossroads for Tibetan and Indian trade coming into China. And yeah, it's an amazing memoir. And he is just a kind of crazy explorer. And he speaks fluent Mandarin and learns Nashi. And it's a really awesome book. I loved it. And I would highly recommend it. What about you, Eric?
I have first from a fellow North Carolinian China watcher or China researcher, Lena Benandalas, who is at Wake Forest's new book, Shaping the Future of Power, Knowledge Production and Network Building in China-Africa Relations. It's a really path-breaking book. And we're going to have her on the show coming weeks. I'm really excited for that. And it looks into the power that lies in the process of knowledge production and social capital formation and skills transfer within China-Africa relations. And really is not very well explored facet of China Global South relations. And it's just really wonderful stuff. Secondly, I've been binge watching Killing Eve. I'm a few years late on it. I seem to be an outsider in my peers in terms of Phoebe Waller-Bridge. I can't stand Fleabag. I think it's a terrible show. But her work on Killing Eve is incredible. And Sandra Oh is amazing. And it's just a really fun, intelligent, feminist kind of take on the spy versus spy. It's delightfully entertaining. And finally, on a sadder note, but also more positive, some of you might have seen the tweet last week, very, very unexpectedly, our Belt and Road mascot, Boo, which is my wife and I's senior pug, got diagnosed and had passed away from cancer. And yeah, but so within that, one just love your pets, any pet that you have. And if you can, and if you're able to adopt a pet, dog, cat, bird, goat, whatever, and give them love. So.
Oh, it's her full name is Princess Boo Bear.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Princess Boo Bear is her full name. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Well, I know. On that note, Tyler, thanks again for joining us on the Belt and Road podcast.
Thanks for having me, Eric and Juliet.
Thanks a lot, Tyler.